cards ready. What are the prospects for getting a complete decrypt?
It's going to take us several weeks to master the new code.
Fitz gave a grunt of exasperation. The reconstruction of new codes from first principles was a painstaking business that could not be hurried. Carver went on,
But I noticed that the message is to be forwarded from Washington to Mexico. On that route, they're still using an old diplomatic code we broke more than a year ago. Perhaps we could get a copy of the forwarded cable.
Perhaps we could,
Fitz said eagerly.
We have an agent in the telegraph office in Mexico City.
He thought ahead. When we reveal this to the world... Carver said anxiously,
We can't do that.
Why not?
The Germans would know we're reading their traffic.
Fitz saw that he was right. It was the perennial problem of secret intelligence, how to use it without compromising the source. He said,
But this is so important, we might want to take the risk.
I doubt it. The department has provided too much reliable information. They won't put that in jeopardy.
Damn. Surely we can't come across something like this and then be powerless to use it?
Carver shrugged.
It happens in this line of work.
Fitz was not prepared to accept that. The entry of America could win the war. That was surely worth any sacrifice. But he knew enough about the army to realize that some men would show more courage and resourcefulness defending a department than a redoubt. Carver's objection had to be taken seriously.
We need a cover story, he said. Let's say the Americans intercepted the cable,
Carver said. Fitz nodded. It is to be forwarded from Washington to Mexico, so we could say the U.S. government got it from Western Union.
Western Union may not like it.
To hell with them. Now, how exactly do we use this information to the maximum effect? Does our government make the announcement? Do we give it to the Americans? Do we get some third party to challenge the Germans? Carver put up both hands in a gesture of surrender.
I'm out of my depth.
I'm not, said Fitz, suddenly inspired, and I know just the person to help. 3. Fitz met Gus Dewar at a South London pub called The Ring. To Fitz's surprise, Dewar was a lover of boxing. As a teenager, he had attended a waterfront arena in Buffalo, and in his travels across Europe, back in 1914, he had watched prize fights in every capital city. He kept his enthusiasm quiet, Fitz thought wryly. Boxing was not a popular topic of conversation at tea time in Mayfair. However, all classes were represented at the ring. Gentlemen in evening dress mingled with dockers in torn coats. Illegal bookmakers took bets in every corner, while waiters brought loaded trays of beer in pint glasses. The air was thick with the smoke of cigars, pipes, and cigarettes. There were no seats and no women. Fitz found Gus deep in conversation with a broken-nosed Londoner, arguing about the American fighter Jack Johnson, the first black world heavyweight champion, whose marriage to a white woman had caused Christian ministers to call for him to be lynched. The Londoner had riled Gus by agreeing with the clergyman. Fitz nourished a secret hope that Gus might fall for Maud. It would be a good match. They were both intellectuals, both liberals, both frightfully serious about everything, always reading books. The Dewars came from what Americans called old money, the nearest thing they had to an aristocracy. In addition, both Gus and Maud were in favor of peace. Maud had always been strangely passionate about ending the war. Fitz had no idea why. And Gus revered his boss, Woodrow Wilson, who had made a speech a month ago calling for peace without victory, a phrase that had infuriated Fitz and most of the British and French leadership. But the compatibility Fitz had seen between Gus and Maud had not led anywhere. Fitz loved his sister, but he wondered what was wrong with her. Did she want to be an old maid? When Fitz had detached Gus from the man with a broken nose, he raised the subject of Mexico.
It's a mess, Gus said. Wilson has withdrawn General Pershing and his troops in an attempt to please President Carranza, but it hasn't worked. Carranza won't even discuss policing the border.
Why do you ask?
I'll tell you later, Fitz said.
The next bout is starting. As they watched a fighter called Benny the Yid pounding the brains of bald Albert Collins, Fitz resolved to avoid the topic of the German peace offer. He knew that Gus was heartbroken at the failure of Wilson's initiative. Gus asked himself constantly whether he could have handled matters better or done something further to support the president's plan. Fitz thought the plan had been doomed from the start,
because neither side really wanted peace. In the third round, Bald Albert went down and stayed down.
"You caught me just in time," Gus said. "I'm about to head for home. Looking forward to it. If I get there, I might be sunk by a U-boat on the way."
The Germans had resumed unrestricted submarine warfare on February 1st, exactly as foretold in the Zimmermann intercept. This had angered the Americans, but not as much as Fitz had hoped. President Wilson's reaction to the submarine announcement was surprisingly mild, he said.
"He broke off diplomatic relations with Germany. That's not mild.
But he did not declare war." Fitz had been devastated by this. He had fought hard against peace talks, but Maud and Ethel and their pacifist friends were right to say there was no hope of victory in the foreseeable future without extra help from somewhere. Fitz had felt sure that unrestricted submarine warfare would bring the Americans in. So far, it had not.
Gus said, "Frankly, I think President Wilson was infuriated by the submarine decision and is now ready to declare war. He's tried everything else, for goodness sake, but he won re-election as the man who kept us out. The only way he can switch is if he is swept into war on a tide of public enthusiasm."
"In that case," said Fitz, "I believe I have something that might help him." Gus raised an eyebrow.
"Since I was wounded, I've been working in a unit that decodes intercepted German wireless messages."
Fitz took from his pocket a sheet of paper covered with his own handwriting.
"Your government will be given this officially in the next few days. I'm showing it to you now because we need advice on how to handle it."
He gave it to Gus. The British spy in Mexico City had got hold of the relayed message in the old code, and the paper Fitz handed to Gus was a complete decrypt of the Zimmermann intercept. In full, it read, "Washington to Mexico, 19th January 1917. We intend to begin on 1st February unrestricted submarine warfare. We shall endeavor, in spite of this, to keep the USA neutral. In the event of this not succeeding, we make Mexico a proposal of alliance on the following terms. Make war together, make peace together. Generous financial support and an undertaking on our part that Mexico is to reconquer the lost territory in Texas, New Mexico, and Arizona. The settlement in detail is left to you. You will inform the president of the above most secretly as soon as the outbreak of war with the USA is certain, and add the suggestion that he should, on his own initiative, invite Japan to immediate adherence and at the same time mediate between Japan and ourselves. Please call the president's attention to the fact that the ruthless employment of our submarines now offers the prospect of compelling England in a few months to make peace." Gus read a few lines, holding the sheet close to his eyes in the low light of the boxing arena, and said,
"Alliance? My God!"
Fitz glanced around. A new bout had begun, and the noise of the crowd was too loud for people nearby to overhear Gus. Gus read on.
"Reconquer Texas," he said with incredulity. And then, angrily, "invite Japan."
He looked up from the paper.
"This is outrageous."
This was the reaction Fitz had been hoping for, and he had to quell his elation.
"Outrageous is the word," he said with forced solemnity.
"The Germans are offering to pay Mexico to invade the United States."
"Yes."
"And they're asking Mexico to try to get Japan to join in."
"Yes." "Wait till this gets out."
"That's what I want to talk to you about. We want to make sure it's publicized in a manner favorable to your president."
"Why doesn't the British government simply reveal it to the world?"
Gus was not thinking this through.
"Two reasons," Fitz said. "One, we don't want the Germans to know we're reading their cables. Two, we may be accused of forging this intercept."
Gus nodded.
"Pardon me. I was too angry to think. Let's look at this coolly. If possible, we would like you to say that the United States government obtained a copy of the cable from Western Union."
"Wilson won't tell a lie."
"Then get a copy from Western Union, and it won't be a lie."
Gus nodded. "That should be possible. As for the second problem, who could release the telegram without being suspected of forgery?"
"The president himself, I presume."
"That's one possibility."
"But you have a better idea."
"Yes," Gus said thoughtfully.
"I believe I do."
4. Ethel and Bernie got married in the Calvary Gospel Hall. Neither of them had strong views about religion, and they both liked the pastor. Ethel had not communicated with Fitz since the day of Lloyd George's speech. Fitz's public opposition to peace had reminded her harshly of his true nature. He stood for everything she hated: tradition, conservatism, exploitation of the working class, unearned wealth. She could not be the lover of such a man, and she felt ashamed of herself for even being tempted by the house in Chelsea. Her true soulmate was Bernie. Ethel wore the pink silk dress and flowered hat that Walter von Ulrich had bought her for Maud Fitzherbert's wedding. There were no bridesmaids, but Mildred and Maud served as matrons of honour. Ethel's parents came up from Aberowen on the train. Sadly, Billy was in France and could not get leave. Little Lloyd wore a pageboy outfit specially made for him by Mildred, sky blue with brass buttons and a cap. Bernie surprised Ethel by producing a family no one knew about. His elderly mother spoke nothing but Yiddish and muttered under her breath all through the service. She lived with Bernie's prosperous older brother, Theo, who, Mildred discovered, flirting with him, owned a bicycle factory in Birmingham. Afterward, tea and cake were served in the hall. There were no alcoholic drinks, which suited Da and Mam, and smokers had to go outside. Mam kissed Ethel and said, "I'm glad to see you settled at last, anyway." The word anyway carried a lot of baggage, Ethel thought. It meant, congratulations, even though you're a fallen woman, and you've got an illegitimate child whose father no one knows, and you're marrying a Jew and living in London, which is the same as Sodom and Gomorrah. But Ethel accepted Mam's qualified blessing and vowed never to say such things to her own child. Mam and Da had bought cheap day-return tickets, and they left to catch their train. When the majority of guests had gone, the remainder went to the Dog and Duck for a few drinks. Ethel and Bernie went home when it was Lloyd's bedtime. That morning Bernie had put his few clothes and many books into a handcart and wheeled it from his rented lodgings to Ethel's house. To give themselves one night alone, they put Lloyd to bed upstairs with Mildred's children, which Lloyd regarded as a special treat. Then Ethel and Bernie had cocoa in the kitchen and went to bed. Ethel had a new nightdress. Bernie put on clean pyjamas. When he got into bed beside her, he broke into a nervous sweat. Ethel stroked his cheek. "Although I'm a scarlet woman, I haven't got much experience," she said. "Just my first husband, and that was only for a few weeks before he went away." She had not told Bernie about Fitz, and never would. Only Billy and the lawyer Albert Solman knew the truth. "You're better off than me," Bernie said, but already she could feel him beginning to relax. "Just a few fumbles." "What were their names?" "Ah, you don't want to know." She grinned. "Yes, I do. How many women? 6, 10, 20? "Good God, no, 3. The first was Rachel Wright in school. Afterwards, she said we would have to get married, and I believed her. I was so worried." Ethel giggled. "What happened?" "The next week, she did it with Mickey Armstrong, and I was off the hook." "Was it nice with her?" "I suppose it was. I was only 16. Mainly I just wanted to be able to say I had done it." She kissed him gently, then said, "Who was next?" "Carol McAllister. She was a neighbour. I paid her a shilling. It was a bit brief. I think she knew what to do and say to get it over quickly. The part she liked was taking the money." Ethel frowned disapprovingly, then recalled the house in Chelsea, and realized she had contemplated doing the same as Carol McAllister. Feeling uncomfortable, she said, "Who was the other one?" "An older woman. She was my landlady. She came to my bed at night when her husband was away." "Was it nice with her?" "Lovely. It was a happy time for me." "What went wrong?" "Her husband got suspicious and I had to leave." "And then?" "Then I met you, and I lost all interest in other women." They began to kiss. Soon he pushed up the skirt of her nightdress and got on top of her. He was gentle, worried about hurting her, but he entered her easily. She felt a surge of affection for him, for his kindness and intelligence and devotion to her and her child. She put her arms around him and hugged his body to hers. Quite soon, his climax came. Then they both lay back, content, and went to sleep. 5. Women's skirts had changed, Gus Duer realized. They now showed the ankles. 10 years ago, a glimpse of ankle had been arousing. Now it was mundane. Perhaps women covered their nakedness to make themselves more alluring, not less.
Rosa Hellman was wearing a dark red coat that fell in pleats from the yoke at the back, rather fashionable. It was trimmed with black fur, which he guessed was welcome in Washington in February. Her grey hat was small and round, with a red hatband and a feather. Not very practical, but when was the last time American women's hats had been designed for practical purposes? "I'm honored by this invitation," she said. He could not be sure whether she was mocking him. "You're only just back from Europe, aren't you?" They were having lunch in the dining room of the Willard Hotel, 2 blocks east of the White House. Gus had invited her for a specific purpose. "I've got a story for you," he said as soon as they had ordered.
"Oh, good. Let me guess. The president is going to divorce Edith and marry Mary Peck."
Gus frowned. Wilson had had a dalliance with Mary Peck while he was married to his first wife. Gus doubted whether they had actually committed adultery, but Wilson had been foolish enough to write letters that showed more affection than was seemly. Washington gossips knew all about it, but nothing had been printed. "I'm talking about something serious," Gus said sternly.
"Oh, sorry,"
said Rosa. She composed her face in a solemn expression that made Gus want to laugh. "The only condition is going to be that you can't say you got the information from the White House."
"Agreed."
"I'm going to show you a telegram from the German Foreign Minister, Arthur Zimmermann, to the German ambassador in Mexico." She looked astonished.
"Where did you get that?"
"From Western Union," he lied.
"Isn't it in code?"
"Codes can be broken." He handed her a typewritten copy of the full English translation.
"Is this off the record?" she said.
"No. The only thing I want you to keep to yourself is where you got it."
"Okay."
She began to read. After a moment, her mouth dropped open. She looked up.
"Gus," she said, "is this real?
When did you know me to play a practical joke?"
"The last time was never,"
she read on.
"The Germans are going to pay Mexico to invade Texas?"
"That's what Herr Zimmermann says."
"This isn't a story, Gus. This is the scoop of the century."
He allowed himself a small smile, trying not to appear as triumphant as he felt.
"That's what I thought you'd say. Are you acting independently, or on behalf of the president?"
"Rosa, do you imagine I would do a thing like this without approval from the very top?"
"I guess not." "Wow! So this comes to me from President Wilson?"
"Not officially."
"But how do I know it's true?"
"I don't think I can write the story based only on a scrap of paper and your word." Gus had anticipated this snag. "Secretary of State Lansing will personally confirm the authenticity of the telegram to your boss, provided the conversation is confidential."
"Good enough."
She looked down at the sheet of paper again.
"This changes everything. Can you imagine what the American people will say when they read it?"
"I think it will make them more inclined to join the war and fight against Germany."
"Inclined?" she said. "They're going to be foaming at the mouth. Wilson will have to declare war."
Gus said nothing. After a moment, Rosa interpreted his silence.
"Oh, I see.
That's why you're releasing the telegram. The president wants to declare war." She was dead right. He smiled, enjoying this dance of wits with a bright woman.
"I'm not saying that. But this telegram will anger the American people so much that they will demand war. And Wilson will be able to say he did not renege on his election promises. He was forced by public opinion to change his policy."
She was, in fact, a bit too bright for his purposes. He said anxiously, "That's not the story you'll write, is it?" She smiled.
"Oh, no. That's just me refusing to take anything at face value. I was an anarchist once, you know.
And now?"
"Now I'm a reporter, and there's only one way to write this story."
He felt relieved. The waiter brought their food. Poached salmon for her, steak and mashed potatoes for him. Rosa stood up.
"I have to get back to the office."
Gus was startled. "What about your lunch?"
"Are you serious?" she said. "I can't eat. Don't you understand what you've done?"
He thought he did, but he said,
"Tell me. You've just sent America to war."
Gus nodded.
"I know," he said.
"Go write the story."
"Hey,"
she said.
"Thanks for picking me."
A moment later, she was gone. Chapter 23. March 1917. That winter in Petrograd was cold and hungry.
The thermometer outside the barracks of the 1st Machine Gun Regiment stayed at minus 15 degrees centigrade for a full month. Bakers stopped making pies, cakes, pastries, and anything else other than bread, but still there was not enough flour. Armed guards were posted at the barracks kitchen door because so many soldiers tried to beg or steal extra food. One bitterly cold day, early in March, Grigori got an afternoon pass and decided to go and see Vladimir, who would be with the landlady while Katerina was at work. He put on his army greatcoat and set off through icy streets. On Nevsky Prospect, he caught the eye of a child beggar, a girl of about 9, standing on a corner in an arctic wind. Something about her bothered him, and he frowned as he walked past. A minute later he realized what had struck him. She had given him a look of sexual invitation. He was so shocked that he stopped in his tracks. How could she be a whore at that age? He turned around, intending to question her, but she was gone. He walked on with a troubled mind. He knew, of course, that there were men who wanted sex with children. He had learned that when he and little Lev sought help from a priest all those years ago. But somehow, the picture of that 9-year-old pathetically imitating a come-hither smile wrenched at his heart. It made him want to weep for his country. "We are turning our children into prostitutes," he thought. "Can it possibly get any worse?" He was in a grim mood when he reached his old lodgings. As soon as he entered the house, he heard Vladimir bawling. He went up to Katerina's room and found the child alone, his face red and contorted with crying. He picked him up and rocked him. The room was clean and tidy and smelled of Katerina. Grigori came here most Sundays. They had a routine. They went out in the morning, then came home and made lunch, with food Grigori brought from the barracks, when he could get any. Afterward, while Vladimir had his nap, they made love. On Sundays, when there was enough to eat, Grigori was blissfully happy in this room. Vladimir's yelling became a droning, discontented grizzle. With the child in his arms, Grigori went to look for the landlady, who was supposed to be watching Vladimir. He found her in the laundry, a low-built extension at the back of the house, running wet bedsheets through a mangle. She was a woman of about 50 with grey hair tied up in a scarf. She had been plump back in 1914 when Grigori left to go in the army, but now her throat was scraggy and her jowls hung loose. Even landladies were hungry these days. She looked startled and guilty when she saw him. Grigori said, "Didn't you hear the child crying? I can't rock him all day," she said defensively, and went on turning the handle of the wringer. "Perhaps he's hungry." "He's had his milk," she said quickly. Her response was suspiciously rapid, and Grigori guessed she had drunk the milk herself. He wanted to strangle her. In the cold air of the unheated laundry, he felt Vladimir's soft baby skin radiating heat. "I think he's got a fever," he said. "Didn't you notice his temperature? Am I a doctor now, too?" Vladimir stopped crying and fell into a state of lassitude that Grigori found more worrying. He was normally an alert, busy child, curious and mildly destructive, but now he lay still in Grigori's arms, his face flushed, his eyes staring. Grigori put him back on his bed in the corner of Katerina's room. He took a jug from Katerina's shelf, left the house, and hurried to the next street, where there was a general store. He bought some milk, a little sugar in a twist of paper, and an apple. When he got back, Vladimir was the same. He warmed the milk, dissolved the sugar in it, and broke a crust of stale bread into the mixture, then fed morsels of soaked bread to Vladimir. He recalled his mother giving this to baby Lev when he was sick. Vladimir ate as if he was hungry and thirsty. When all the bread and milk were gone, Grigori took out the apple. With his pocket knife, he cut it into segments and peeled a slice. He ate the peel himself and offered the rest to Vladimir, saying, "Some for me, some for you." In the past, the boy had been amused by this procedure, but now he was indifferent and let the apple fall from his mouth. There was no doctor nearby, and anyway Grigori could not afford the fee, but there was a midwife a few streets away. She was Magda, the pretty wife of Grigori's old friend Konstantin, the secretary of the Putilov Bolshevik Committee. Grigori and Konstantin played chess whenever they got the chance. Grigori usually won. Grigori put a clean diaper on Vladimir, then wrapped him in the blanket from Katerina's bed, leaving only his eyes and nose visible. They went out into the cold. Konstantin and Magda lived in a two-room apartment with Magda's aunt, who watched their three small children. Grigori was afraid Magda would be out delivering a baby, but he was in luck, and she was at home. Magda was knowledgeable and kind-hearted, though a bit brisk. She felt Vladimir's forehead and said, "He has an infection."
"How bad? Does he cough?"
"No."
"What are his stools like?"
"Runny."
She took off Vladimir's clothes and said,
"I suppose Katerina's breasts have no milk."
"How did you know that?"
Grigori said in surprise.
"It's common. A woman cannot feed a baby unless she herself is fed. Nothing comes from nothing. That's why the child is so thin."
Grigori did not know Vladimir was thin. Magda poked Vladimir's belly and made him cry.
"Inflammation of the bowels," she said.
"Will he be all right?"
"Probably. Children get infections all the time. They usually survive."
"What can we do?"
"Bathe his forehead with tepid water to bring down his temperature. Give him plenty to drink, all he wants. Don't worry about whether he eats. Feed Katerina so that she can nurse him. Mother's milk is what he needs."
Grigori took Vladimir home. He bought more milk on the way and warmed it up on the fire. He gave it to Vladimir on a teaspoon, and the boy drank it all. Then he warmed a pan of water and bathed Vladimir's face with a rag. It seemed to work. The child lost the flushed, staring look and began to breathe normally. Grigori was feeling less anxious when Katerina came home at 7:30. She looked tired and cold. She had bought a cabbage and a few grams of pork fat, and Grigori put them in a saucepan to make stew while she rested. He told her about Vladimir's fever, the negligent landlady, and Magda's prescription.
"What can I do?"
Katerina said with weary despair.
"I have to go to the factory. There is no one else to watch Volodya."
Grigori fed the child with the broth from the stew, then put him down to sleep. When Grigori and Katerina had eaten, they lay on the bed together.
"Don't let me sleep too long," Katerina said. "I have to join the bread queue."
"I'll go for you," Grigori said. "You rest."
He would be late back to the barracks, but he could probably get away with that. The officers were too fearful of mutiny these days to make a fuss about minor transgressions. Katerina took him at his word and fell into a deep sleep. When he heard the church clock strike 2, he put on his boots and greatcoat. Vladimir seemed to be sleeping normally. Grigori left the house and walked to the bakery. To his surprise, there was already a long queue, and he realized he had left it a bit late. There were about 100 people in line, muffled up, stamping their feet in the snow. Some had brought chairs or stools. An enterprising young man with a brazier was selling porridge, washing the bowls in the snow when they were done with. A dozen more people joined the queue behind Grigori. They gossiped and grumbled while they waited. Two women ahead of Grigori argued about who was to blame for the bread shortage. One said, "Germans at court," the other, "Jews hoarding flour."
"Who rules?" Grigori said to them. "If a streetcar overturns, you blame the driver, because he was in charge. The Jews don't rule us. The Germans don't rule us. It's the Tsar and the nobility."
This was the Bolshevik message.
"Who would rule if there was no Tsar?"
said the younger woman skeptically. She was wearing a yellow felt hat.
"I think we should rule ourselves," said Grigori, "as they do in France and America."
"I don't know," said the older woman. "It can't go on like this."
The shop opened at 5. A minute later, the news came down the line that customers were rationed to one loaf per person.
"All night, just for one loaf," said the woman in the yellow hat.
It took another hour to shuffle to the head of the queue. The baker's wife was admitting customers one at a time. The older of the two women ahead of Grigori went in. Then the baker's wife said,
"That's all. No more bread."
The woman in the yellow hat said,
"No, please, just one more."
The baker's wife wore a stony expression. Perhaps this had happened before.
"If he had more flour, he'd bake more bread," she said. "It's all gone, do you hear me? I can't sell you bread if I haven't got any."
The last customer came out of the shop with her loaf under her coat and hurried away. The woman in the yellow hat began to cry. The baker's wife slammed the door. Grigori turned and walked away. 2. Spring came to Petrograd on Thursday, March 8th, but the Russian Empire clung obstinately to the calendar of Julius Caesar, so they called it February 23rd. The rest of Europe had been using the modern calendar for 300 years. The rise in temperature coincided with International Women's Day, and the female workers from the textile mills came out on strike and marched from the industrial suburbs into the city centre to protest against the bread queues, the war, and the Tsar. Bread rationing had been announced, but it seemed to have made the shortage worse. The 1st Machine Gun Regiment, like all army units in the city, was detailed to help the police and the mounted Cossacks keep order. What would happen, Grigori wondered, if the soldiers were ordered to fire on the marchers? Would they obey, or would they turn their rifles on their officers? In 1905 they had obeyed orders and shot workers, but since then the Russian people had suffered a decade of tyranny, repression, war, and hunger. However, there was no trouble, and Grigori and his section returned to barracks that evening without having fired a shot. On Friday, more workers came out on strike. The Tsar was at army headquarters, 400 miles away, at Mogilev. In charge of the city was the commander of the Petrograd military district, General Kabanov. He decided to keep marchers out of the center by stationing soldiers at the bridges. Grigori's section was posted close to the barracks, guarding the Liteyny Bridge that led across the Neva River to Liteyny Prospect. But the water was still frozen solid, and the marchers foiled the army by simply walking across the ice, to the delight of the watching soldiers, most of whom, like Grigori, sympathized with the marchers. None of the political parties had organized the strike. The Bolsheviks, like the other leftist revolutionary parties, found themselves following rather than leading the working class. Once again, Grigori's section saw no action, but it was not the same everywhere. When he got back to barracks on Saturday night, he learned that police had attacked demonstrators outside the railway station at the far end of Nevsky Prospect. Surprisingly, the Cossacks had defended the marchers against the police. Men were talking about the comrade Cossacks. Grigori was skeptical. The Cossacks had never really been loyal to anyone but themselves, he thought. They just loved to fight. On Sunday morning, Grigori was awakened at 5, long before first light. At breakfast, there was a rumor that the Tsar had instructed General Kabalov to put a stop to strikes and marches, using whatever force was necessary. That was an ominous phrase, Grigori thought, whatever force was necessary. After breakfast, the sergeants were given their orders. Each platoon was to guard a different point in the city, not just bridges, but intersections, railway stations, and post offices. The pickets would be connected by field telephones. The nation's capital was to be secured like a captured enemy city. Worst of all, the regiment was to set up machine guns at likely trouble spots. When Grigori relayed the instructions to his men, they were horrified. Isaac said, "Is the Tsar really going to order the army to machine gun his own people?" Grigori said, "If he does, will soldiers obey him?" Grigori's mounting excitement was paralleled by fear. He was heartened by the strikes, for he knew the Russian people had to defy their rulers. Otherwise the war would drag on, the people would starve, and there was no prospect that Vladimir might live a better life than Grigori and Katerina. It was this conviction that had caused Grigori to join the party. On the other hand, he cherished a secret hope that if soldiers simply refused to obey orders, the revolution might go off without too much bloodshed. But when his own regiment was ordered to set up machine gun emplacements on Petrograd street corners, he began to feel that his hope had been foolish. Was it even possible that the Russian people could ever escape from the tyranny of the Tsars? Sometimes it seemed like a pipe dream. Yet other nations had had revolutions and overthrown their oppressors. Even the English had killed their king once. Petrograd was like a pan of water on fire, Grigori thought. There were wisps of steam and a few bubbles of violence, and the surface shimmered with intense heat. But the water seemed to hesitate, and the proverbial watched pot did not boil. His platoon was sent to the Taurida Palace, the vast summer townhouse of Catherine II, now home to Russia's toothless parliament, the Duma. The morning was quiet. Even starving people liked to sleep late on Sunday. But the weather continued sunny, and at midday they started to come in from the suburbs, on foot and in streetcars. Some gathered in the large garden of the Taurida Palace. They were not all factory workers, Grigori noticed. There were middle-class men and women, students, and a few prosperous-looking businessmen. Some had brought their children. Were they on a political demonstration or just going for a walk in the park? Grigori guessed they themselves were not sure. At the entrance to the palace, he saw a well-dressed young man whose handsome face was familiar from photographs in the newspapers, and he recognized the Trudovik deputy, Alexander Fedorovich Kerensky.
The Trudoviks were a moderate breakaway faction from the socialist revolutionaries. Grigori asked him what was going on inside.
The Tsar formally dissolved the Duma today, Kerensky told him.
Grigori shook his head in disgust.
A characteristic reaction, he said.
Repress those who complain, rather than address their discontents. Kerensky looked at him sharply. Perhaps he had not been expecting such an analysis from a soldier.
Quite, he said. Anyway, we deputies are ignoring the Tsar's edict.
What will happen?
Most people think the demonstrations will peter out as soon as the authorities manage to restore the supply of bread, Kerensky said, and he went inside.
Grigori wondered what made the moderates think that was going to happen. If the authorities were able to restore the supply of bread, would they not have done so, instead of rationing it? But moderates always seem to deal in hopes rather than facts. Early in the afternoon, Grigori was surprised to see the smiling faces of Katerina and Vladimir. He normally spent Sunday with them, but had assumed he would not see them today. Vladimir looked well and happy, much to Grigori's relief. Evidently the boy had got over the infection. It was warm enough for Katerina to wear her coat open, showing her voluptuous figure. He wished he could caress her. She smiled at him, making him think of how she would kiss his face as they lay on the bed, and Grigori felt a stab of yearning that was almost unbearable. He hated to miss that Sunday afternoon embrace.
"How did you know I would be here?" he asked her.
"It was a lucky guess.
I'm glad to see you, but it's dangerous for you to be in the city center."
Katerina looked at the crowds strolling through the park.
"It seems safe enough to me."
Grigori could not dispute that. There was no sign of trouble. Mother and child went off to walk around the frozen lake. Grigori's breath caught in his throat as he watched Vladimir toddle away and almost immediately fall over. Katerina picked him up, soothed him, and walked on. They looked so vulnerable. What was going to happen to them? When they returned, Katerina said she was taking Vladimir home for his nap.
"Go by the back streets," Grigori said. "Keep away from the crowds. I don't know what might happen."
"All right," she said. "Promise.
I promise."
Grigori saw no bloodshed that day, but at the barracks in the evening he heard a different story from other groups. In Znamenskaya Square, soldiers had been ordered to shoot demonstrators, and 40 people had died. Grigori felt a cold hand on his heart. Katerina might have been killed just walking along the street. Others were equally outraged, and in the mess hall feelings were running high. Sensing the mood of the men, Grigori stood on a table and took charge, calling for order and inviting soldiers to speak in turn. Supper turned rapidly into a mass meeting. He called first on Isaac, who was well known as the star of the regimental soccer team.
"I joined the army to kill Germans, not Russians," Isaac said, and there was a roar of approval. "The marchers are our brothers and sisters, our mothers and fathers, and their only crime is to ask for bread."
Grigori knew all the Bolsheviks in the regiment, and he called on several of them to speak, but he was careful to point to others too, not to seem overly biased. Normally the men were cautious about expressing their opinions, for fear their remarks would be reported and they would be punished, but today they did not seem to care. The speaker who made the greatest impression was Yakov, a tall man with shoulders like a bear. He stood on the table beside Grigori with tears in his eyes.
"When they told us to fire, I didn't know what to do," he said.
He seemed unable to raise his voice, and the room went quiet as the other men strained to hear him.
"I said, 'God, please guide me now,' and I listened in my heart. But God sent me no answer."
The men were silent.
"I raised my rifle," Yakov said. "The captain was screaming, 'Shoot, shoot,' but who should I shoot at? In Galicia, we knew who our enemies were because they were firing at us. But today in the square, no one was attacking us. The people were mostly women, some with children. Even the men had no weapons."
He fell silent. The men were as still as stones, as if they feared that any movement might break the spell. After a moment, Isaac prompted him.
"What happened next, Yakov Davidovich?"
"I pulled the trigger,"
Yakov said, and the tears ran from his eyes into his bushy black beard.
"I didn't even aim the gun. The captain was screaming at me and I fired just to shut him up. But I hit a woman. A girl, really. About 19, I suppose. She had a green coat. I shot her in the chest, and the blood went all over the coat, red on green. Then she fell down.
He was weeping openly now, speaking in gasps.
I dropped my gun and tried to go to her, to help her, but the crowd went for me, punching and kicking, though I hardly felt it.
He wiped his face with his sleeve.
I'm in trouble now, for losing my rifle.
There was another long pause.
19, he said. I think she must have been about 19.
Grigori had not noticed the door opening, but suddenly Lieutenant Krylov was there.
Get off that damn table, Yakov,
he shouted. He looked at Grigori.
You too, Peshkov, you troublemaker.
He turned and spoke to the men, sitting on benches at their trestle tables.
Return to your barracks, all of you, he said. Anyone still in this room 1 minute from now gets a flogging.
No one moved. The men stared surlily at the lieutenant. Grigori wondered if this was how a mutiny started. But Yakov was too lost in his misery to realize what a moment of drama he had created. He got down clumsily from the table, and the tension was released. Some of the men close to Krylov stood up, looking sullen but scared. Grigori remained defiantly standing on the table a few moments longer, but he sensed that the men were not quite angry enough to turn on an officer, so in the end he got down. The men started to leave the room. Krylov remained where he was, glaring at everyone. Grigori returned to barracks, and soon the bell rang for lights out. As a sergeant, he had the privilege of a curtained niche at the end of his platoon's dormitory. He could hear the men speaking in low voices.
I won't shoot women, said one. Me neither.
A third voice said, if you don't, some of these bastard officers will shoot you for disobedience. I'm going to aim to miss, said another voice.
They might see.
You only have to aim a bit above the heads of the crowd. No one can be sure what you're doing.
That's what I'm going to do, said another voice. Me too, me too.
We'll see, Grigori thought as he drifted off to sleep. Brave words came easily in the dark. Daylight might tell a different story. 3. On Monday, Grigori's platoon was marched the short distance along Samson Nevsky Prospect to the Liteyny Bridge and ordered to prevent demonstrators crossing the river to the city center. The bridge was 400 yards long and rested on massive stone piers set into the frozen river like stranded icebreakers. This was the same job they had had on Friday, but the orders were different. Lieutenant Krylov briefed Grigori. He spoke these days as if he was in a constant bad temper, and perhaps he was. Officers probably disliked being lined up against their own countrymen just as much as the men did. No marchers are to cross the river, either by the bridge or on the ice, do you understand? You will shoot people who flout your instructions. Grigori hid his contempt.
Yes, Excellency,
he said smartly. Krylov repeated the orders, then disappeared. Grigori thought the lieutenant was scared. Doubtless he feared being held responsible for what happened, whether his orders were obeyed or defied. Grigori had no intention of obeying. He would allow the leaders of the march to engage him in discussion while their followers crossed the ice, exactly as it had played out on Friday. However, early in the morning his platoon was joined by a detachment of police. To his horror, he saw that they were led by his old enemy, Mikhail Pinsky. The man did not appear to be suffering from the shortage of bread. His round face was fatter than ever, and his police uniform was tight around the middle. He was carrying a loudhailer. His weasel-faced sidekick, Kozlov, was nowhere in sight.
I know you, Pinsky said to Grigori. You used to work at the Putilov factory.
Until you had me conscripted, Grigori said. Your brother is a murderer, but he escaped to America.
So you say. No one is going to cross the river here today.
We shall see.
I expect full cooperation from your men. Is that understood?
Grigori said.
Aren't you afraid? Of the rebel? Don't be stupid.
No. I mean of the future. Suppose the revolutionaries get their way. What do you think they will do to you? You've spent your life bullying the weak, beating people up, harassing women and taking bribes. Don't you fear a day of retribution?
Pinsky pointed a gloved finger at Grigori.
I'm reporting you as a damned subversive, he said, and he walked away.
Grigori shrugged. It was not as easy as it used to be for the police to arrest anyone they liked. Isaac and others might mutiny if Grigori was jailed, and the officers knew it.
The day started quietly, but Grigori noted that few workers were on the streets. Many factories were closed because they could not get fuel for their steam engines and furnaces. Other places were on strike, the employees demanding more money to pay inflated prices, or heating for ice-cold workshops, or safety rails around dangerous machinery. It looked as if almost no one was actually going to work today. But the sun rose cheerfully, and people were not going to stay indoors. Sure enough, at mid-morning, Grigori saw, coming along Samsonyevsky Prospect, a large crowd of men and women in the ragged clothes of industrial workers. Grigori had 30 men and 2 corporals. He had stationed them in 4 lines of 8 across the road, blocking the end of the bridge. Pinsky had about the same number of men, half on foot and half on horseback, and he placed them at the sides of the road. Grigori peered anxiously at the oncoming march. He could not predict what would happen. On his own, he could have prevented bloodshed by offering only token resistance, then letting the demonstrators pass. But he did not know what Pinsky was going to do. The marchers came nearer. There were hundreds of people. No, thousands. They were men and women in the blue tunics and ragged coats of industrial workers. Most wore red armbands or red ribbons. Their banners read, "Down with the Tsar," and "Bread, Peace, and Land." This was no longer merely a protest, Grigori concluded. It had become a political movement. As the leaders came nearer, he sensed the tightening anxiety among his waiting men. He walked forward to meet the marchers. At their head, to his surprise, was Varya, the mother of Constantine. Her grey hair was tied up in a red scarf, and she carried a red flag on a hefty stick. "Hello, Grigori Sergeyevich," she said amiably. "Are you going to shoot me?" "No, I'm not," he replied, "but I can't speak for the police." Although Varya stopped, the others came on, pressed from behind by thousands more. Grigori heard Pinsky urge his mounted men forward. These horseback policemen, called pharaohs, were the most hated section of the force. They were armed with whips and clubs. Varya said, "All we want is to make a living and feed our families. Isn't that what you want too, Grigori?" The marchers were not confronting Grigori's soldiers, or attempting to get past them onto the bridge. Instead, they were spreading out along the embankment on both sides. Pinsky's pharaohs nervously walked their horses along the towpath, as if to bar the way to the ice, but there were not enough of them to form a continuous barrier. However, no marcher wanted to be the first to make a dash for it, and there was a moment of stalemate. Lieutenant Pinsky put his megaphone to his mouth. "Go back!" he shouted. The instrument was no more than a piece of tin shaped like a cone, and made his voice only a little louder. "You may not enter the city center. Return to your workplaces in orderly fashion. This is a police command. Go back!" Nobody went back. Most people could not even hear. But the marchers started to jeer and boo. Someone deep in the crowd threw a stone. It struck the rump of a horse, and the beast started. Its rider, taken by surprise, almost fell off. Furious, he pulled himself upright, sword on the reins, and lashed the horse with his whip. The crowd laughed, which made him angrier, but he brought his horse under control. A brave marcher took advantage of the diversion, dodged past a pharaoh on the embankment, and ran onto the ice. Several more people on both sides of the bridge did the same. The pharaohs deployed their whips and clubs, wheeling and rearing their horses as they lashed out. Some of the marchers fell to the ground, but more got through, and others were emboldened to try. In seconds, 30 or more people were running across the frozen river. For Grigori, that was a happy outcome. He could say that he had attempted to enforce the ban, and he had, in fact, kept people off the bridge, but the number of demonstrators was too great, and it had proved impossible to stop people crossing the ice. Pinsky did not see it that way. He turned his megaphone to the armed police and said, "Take aim!" "No!" Grigori shouted, but it was too late. The police took up the firing position on one knee and raised their rifles. Marchers at the front of the crowd tried to go back, but they were pushed forward by the thousands behind them. Some ran for the river, braving the pharaohs. Pinsky shouted, "Fire!" There was a crackle of shots like fireworks, followed by shouts of fear and screams of pain as marchers fell dead and wounded. Grigori was taken back 12 years. He saw the square in front of the Winter Palace, the hundreds of men and women kneeling in prayer, the soldiers with their rifles, and his mother lying on the ground with her blood spreading on the snow. In his mind he heard 11-year-old Lev scream, "She's dead! Ma's dead! My mother is dead!"
"No!" Grigori said aloud. "I will not let them do this again!"
He turned the safety knob on his Mosin Nagant rifle, unlocking the bolt. Then he raised the gun to his shoulder. The crowd was screaming and running in all directions, trampling the fallen. The pharaohs were out of control, lashing out at random. The police fired indiscriminately into the crowd. Grigori aimed carefully at Pinsky, targeting the middle of the body. He was not a very good shot, and Pinsky was 60 yards away, but he had a chance of hitting him. He pulled the trigger. Pinsky continued to yell through his megaphone. Grigori had missed. He lowered his sights. The rifle kicked up a little when fired, and squeezed the trigger again. He missed again. The carnage went on, police shooting wildly into the crowd of fleeing men and women. There were 5 rounds in the magazine of Grigori's rifle. He could usually hit something with one of the 5. He fired a 3rd time. Pinsky gave a shout of pain that was amplified by his megaphone. His right knee seemed to fold under him. He dropped the megaphone and fell to the ground. Grigori's men followed his example. They attacked the police, some firing and some using their rifles as clubs. Others pulled the pharaohs off their horses. The marchers drew courage and joined in. Some of those on the ice turned around and came back. The fury of the mob was ugly. For as long as anyone could remember, the Petrograd police had been sneering brutes, undisciplined and uncontrolled, and now the people took their revenge. Policemen on the ground were kicked and trampled, those on their feet were knocked down, and the pharaohs had their horses shot from under them. The police resisted for only a few moments, then those who could fled. Grigori saw Pinsky struggle to his feet. Grigori took aim again, eager now to finish the bastard off, but a pharaoh got in the way, heaved Pinsky up onto his horse's neck and galloped off. Grigori stood back, watching the police run away. He was in the worst trouble of his life. His platoon had mutinied. In direct contravention of their orders, they had attacked the police, not the marchers, and he had led them by shooting Lieutenant Pinsky, who had survived to tell the tale. There was no way to cover this up, no excuse he could offer that would make any difference, and no escape from punishment. He was guilty of treason. He could be court-martialed and executed. Despite that, he felt happy. Varya pushed through the crowd. There was blood on her face, but she was smiling. "What now, Sergeant?" Grigori was not going to resign himself to his punishment. The Tsar was murdering his people. Well, his people would shoot back. "To the barracks," Grigori said. "Let's arm the working class." He snatched her red flag. "Follow me." He strode back along Samsonyevsky Prospect. His men came after him, marshaled by Isaac, and the crowd fell in behind them. Grigori was not sure exactly what he was going to do, but he did not feel the need of a plan. As he marched at the head of the crowd, he had the sense that he could do anything. The sentry opened the barracks gates for the soldiers, then was unable to close them on the marchers. Feeling invincible, Grigori led the procession across the parade ground to the arsenal. Lieutenant Krylov came out of the headquarters building, saw the crowd, and turned toward them, breaking into a run. "You men!" he shouted. "Halt! Stop right there!" Grigori ignored him. Krylov came to a standstill and drew his revolver. "Halt!" he said. "Halt, or I shoot!" 2 or 3 of Grigori's platoon raised their rifles and fired at Krylov. Several bullets struck him and he fell to the ground, bleeding. Grigori went on. The arsenal was guarded by 2 sentries. Neither of them tried to stop Grigori. He used the last 2 rounds of his magazine to shoot out the lock on the heavy wooden doors. The crowd burst into the arsenal, pushing and shoving to get at the weapons. Some of Grigori's men took charge, opening wooden cases of rifles and revolvers and passing them out along with boxes of ammunition. "This is it," Grigori thought. "This is a revolution." He was exhilarated and terrified at the same time. He armed himself with 2 of the Nagant revolvers that were issued to officers, reloaded his rifle, and filled his pockets with ammunition. He was not sure what he intended to do, but now that he was a criminal, he needed weapons. The rest of the soldiers in the barracks joined in the looting of the arsenal, and soon everyone was armed to the teeth. Carrying Varya's red flag, Grigori led the crowd out of the barracks. Demonstrations always went toward the city center. With Isaac, Yakov, and Varya, he marched across the bridge to Liteny Prospect, heading for the affluent heart of Petrograd. He felt as if he were flying, or dreaming,
as if he had drunk a large mouthful of vodka. For years he had talked about defying the authority of the regime, but today he was doing it, and that made him feel like a new man, a different creature, a bird of the air. He remembered the words of the old man who had spoken to him after his mother was shot dead. "May you live long," the man had said, as Grigori walked away from Palace Square with his mother's body in his arms, "long enough to take revenge on the bloodstained Tsar for the evil he has done this day." "Your wish may come true, old man," he thought exultantly. The first machine guns were not the only regiment to have mutinied this morning. When he reached the far side of the bridge, he was even more elated to see that the streets were full of soldiers wearing their caps backward, or their coats unbuttoned in merry defiance of regulations. Most sported red armbands or red lapel ribbons to show they were revolutionaries. Commandeered cars roared around, erratically driven, rifle barrels and bayonets sticking out of the windows, laughing girls sitting on the soldiers' knees inside. The pickets and checkpoints of yesterday had vanished. The streets had been taken over by the people. Grigori saw a wine shop with its windows broken and its door battered down. A soldier and a girl came out, bottles in both hands, trampling over broken glass. Next door, a cafe proprietor had put plates of smoked fish and sliced sausage on a table outside and stood beside it with a red ribbon in his lapel, smiling nervously and inviting soldiers to help themselves. Grigori guessed he was trying to make sure his place was not broken into and looted like the wine shop. The carnival atmosphere grew as they neared the center. Some people were already quite drunk, although it was only midday. Girls seemed happy to kiss anyone with a red armband, and Grigori saw a soldier openly fondling the large breasts of a smiling middle-aged woman. Some girls had dressed in soldiers' uniforms and swaggered along the streets in caps and oversized boots, evidently feeling liberated. A shiny Rolls-Royce car came along the street and the crowd tried to stop it. The chauffeur put his foot on the gas, but someone opened the door and pulled him out. People shoved one another, trying to get into the car. Grigori saw Count Smakalakov, one of the directors of the Putilov Works, scramble out of the back seat. Grigori recalled how Makalakov had been so entranced with Princess Bea the day she visited the factory. The crowd jeered but did not molest the count as he hurried away, pulling his fur collar up around his ears. 9 or 10 people crammed into his car and someone drove it off, honking blithely. At the next corner, a handful of people were tormenting a tall man in the trilby hat and well-worn greatcoat of a middle-class professional. A soldier poked him with his rifle barrel, an old woman spat at him, and a young man in worker's overalls threw a handful of rubbish. "Let me pass," the man said, trying to sound commanding, but they just laughed. Grigori recognized the thin figure of Kanin, supervisor of the casting section at the Putilov Works. His hat fell off, and Grigori saw that he had gone bald. Grigori pushed through the little crowd. "There's nothing wrong with this man," he shouted. "He's an engineer. I used to work with him." Kanin recognized him. "Thank you, Grigori Sergeyevich," he said. "I'm just trying to make my way to my mother's house to see if she's all right." Grigori turned to the crowd. "Let him pass," he said. "I vouch for him." He saw a woman carrying a reel of red ribbon, looted presumably from a haberdashery, and asked her for a length. She cut some off with a pair of scissors, and Grigori tied it around Kanin's left sleeve. The crowd cheered. "Now you'll be safe," Grigori said. Kanin shook his hand and walked away, and they let him pass. Grigori's group came out onto Nevsky Prospect, the broad shopping street that ran from the Winter Palace to Nikolaevsky Station. It was full of people drinking from bottles, eating, kissing, and firing guns into the air. Those restaurants that were open had signs reading, "Free food for revolutionaries," and "Eat what you like, pay what you can." Many shops had been broken into, and there was smashed glass all over the cobblestones. One of the hated streetcars, priced too high for workers to use, had been overturned in the middle of the road, and a Renault automobile had crashed into it. Grigori heard a rifle shot, but it was one of many, and he thought nothing of it for a second. But then Varya, by his side, staggered and fell down. Grigori and Yakov knelt either side of her. She seemed unconscious. They turned the heavy body over, not without difficulty, and saw immediately that she was beyond help. A bullet had entered her forehead, and her eyes stared up sightlessly. Grigori did not allow himself to feel sorrow, either on his own account or for Varya's son, his best friend, Konstantin. He had learned on the battlefield to fight back first and grieve later.
But was this a battlefield? Who could possibly want to kill Varya? Yet the wound was so exactly placed that he could hardly believe she was the victim of a stray bullet fired at random. His question was answered a moment later. Yakov keeled over, bleeding from his chest. His heavy body hit the cobbles with a thump. Grigori stepped away from the two bodies, saying, "What the hell?" He dropped into a crouch, making himself a smaller target, and rapidly looked around for somewhere he could take cover. He heard another shot, and a passing soldier with a red scarf around his cap fell to the ground, clutching his stomach. There was a sniper, and he was targeting revolutionaries. Grigori ran 3 paces and dived behind the overturned streetcar. A woman screamed, then another. People saw the bleeding bodies and began to run away. Grigori lifted his head and scanned the surrounding buildings. The shooter had to be a police rifleman, but where was he? It seemed to Grigori that the crack of the rifle had come from the other side of the street and less than a block away. The buildings were bright in the afternoon sunlight. There was a hotel, a jewelry store with steel shutters closed, a bank, and on the corner a church. He could see no open windows, so the sniper had to be on a roof. None of the roofs offered cover, except that of the church, which was a stone building in the Baroque style with towers, parapets, and an onion dome. Another shot rang out, and a woman in the clothes of a factory worker screamed and fell, clutching her shoulder. Grigori felt sure the sound had come from the church, but he saw no smoke. That must mean the police had issued their snipers with smokeless ammunition. This really was war. A whole block of Nevsky Prospect was now deserted. Grigori aimed his rifle at the parapet that ran along the top of the side wall of the church. That was the firing position he would have chosen, commanding the whole street. He watched carefully. Out of the corner of his eye he saw 2 more rifles pointing in the same direction as his, held by soldiers who had taken cover nearby. A soldier and a girl came staggering along the street, both drunk. The girl was dancing a jig, raising the skirt of her dress to show her knees, while her boyfriend waltzed around her, holding his rifle to his neck and pretending to play it like a violin. Both wore red armbands. Several people shouted warnings, but the revelers did not hear. As they passed the church, happily oblivious to the danger, 2 shots rang out, and the soldier and his girl fell down. Once again Grigori saw no wisp of smoke, but all the same he fired angrily at the parapet above the church door, emptying his magazine. His bullets chipped the stonework and sent up puffs of dust. The other 2 rifles cracked, and Grigori saw that they were shooting in the same direction, but there was no sign that either of them had hit anything. It was impossible, Grigori thought as he reloaded. They were firing at an invisible target. The sniper must be lying flat, well back from the edge, so that no part of the gun needed to poke through the bars. But he had to be stopped. He had already killed Varya, Yakov, 2 soldiers, and an innocent girl. There was only 1 way to reach him, and that was to get up on the roof. Grigori fired at the parapet again. As he expected, that caused the other 2 soldiers to do the same. Assuming the sniper must have put his head down for a few seconds, Grigori stood up, abandoning the shelter of the overturned streetcar, and ran to the far side of the street, where he flattened himself up against the window of a bookshop, one of the few stores that had not been looted. Keeping within the afternoon shadow cast by the buildings, he made his way along the street to the church. It was separated by an alley from the bank next door. He waited patiently for several minutes, until the shooting started again, then darted across the alley and stood with his back to the east end of the church. Had the sniper seen him run and guessed what he was planning? There was no way to tell. Staying close to the wall, he edged around the church until he came to a small door. It was unlocked. He slipped inside. It was a rich church, gorgeously decorated with red, green, and yellow marble. There was no service taking place at that moment, but 20 or 30 worshippers stood or sat with bowed heads, holding their own private devotions. Grigori scanned the interior, looking for a door that might lead to a staircase. He hurried down the aisle, fearful that more people were being murdered every minute he delayed. A young priest, dramatically handsome, with black hair and white skin, saw his rifle and opened his mouth to voice a protest, but Grigori ignored him and hurried past. In the vestibule he spotted a small wooden door set into a wall. He opened it and saw a spiral staircase leading up. Behind him a voice said, "Stop there, my son. What are you doing?" He turned to see the young priest. "Does this lead to the roof?" "I am Father Mikhail. You can't bring that weapon into the house of God. There's a sniper on your roof."
He is a police officer. You know about him?
Grigori stared at the priest with incredulity.
He's killing people!
The priest made no reply. Grigori ran up the stairs. A cold wind was coming from somewhere above. Clearly, Father Mikhail was on the side of the police. Was there any way the priest could warn the sniper? Not short of running out into the street and waving, which would probably get him shot. After a long climb in near darkness, Grigori saw another door. When his eyes were on a level with the bottom of the door, so that he presented a very small target, he opened it an inch, using his left hand, keeping his rifle in his right. Bright sunlight shone through the gap. He pushed it wide. He could not see anyone. He screwed up his eyes against the sun to scan the area visible through the small rectangle of doorway. He was in the bell tower. The door opened south. Nevsky Prospect was on the north side of the church. The sniper was on the other side, unless he had moved to ambush Grigori. Cautiously, Grigori ascended one step, then another, and put his head out. Nothing happened. He stepped through the door. Under his feet, the roof sloped gently to a gutter that ran alongside a decorative parapet. Wooden duckboards permitted workmen to move around without treading on the roof tiles. At his back, the tower rose to a belfry. Gun in hand, he edged around the tower. At the first corner he found himself looking west, the length of Nevsky Prospect. In the clear light, he could see the Alexander Garden and the Admiralty at the far end. In the middle distance the street was crowded, but nearby it was empty. The sniper must still be at work. Grigori listened, but heard no shots. He sidled farther around the tower until he could look around the next corner. Now he could see all along the north wall of the church. He had felt sure he would find the sniper there, flat on his belly, shooting between the uprights of the parapet, but there was no one in sight. Beyond the parapet, he could see the wide street below, with people crouching in doorways and skulking around corners, waiting to see what would happen. A moment later, the sniper's rifle rang out. A scream from the street told Grigori the man had hit his target. The shot had come from above Grigori's head. He looked up. The bell tower was pierced by glassless windows and flanked by open turrets placed diagonally at the corners. The shooter was up there somewhere, firing out of one of the many available openings. Fortunately, Grigori had remained hard up against the wall, where he could not have been seen by the sniper. Grigori went back inside. Within the confined space of the stairwell, his rifle felt big and clumsy. He put it down and took out one of his pistols. He knew by its weight that it was empty. He cursed. Loading the Nagant M1895 was slow. He took a box of cartridges from the pocket of his uniform coat and inserted seven of them, one by one, through the revolver's awkward loading gate into the cylinder. Then he cocked the hammer. Leaving the rifle behind, he went up the spiral stairs, treading softly. He moved at a steady pace, not wanting to exert himself so much that his breathing would become audible. He kept his revolver in his right hand, pointing up the stairs. After a few moments he smelled smoke. The sniper was having a cigarette. But the pungent smell of